Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Add them up. 57 Democrats is greater than 41 Republicans. So why should a floor vote in the Senate be such a drama?
I do believe the president believes that an up or down vote is necessary.
It would be a political kamikaze mission for the Democratic Party if they jam this through.
The arithmetic is easy. By the numbers, the Democrats win on health care reform. Under reconciliation, there is no magic 60. But the majority is anything but simple in this political equation. Confused? It's the Congress's new math. You're supposed to be confused. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, March 2nd. Celeste Headlee is back.
And I am.
We're doing it by the numbers this morning. Voodoo economics, voodoo politics,
I
fuzzy
remember
math.
The last time Congress decided to change the numbers when they tried to put us on the metric system. How'd that turn out? Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. Residents of Concepcion, Chile plead for aid, water, and security.
Ayuda.
Things not much better in the capital of Santiago.
My husband has go to every supermarket. There's no water. We're trying to look for diapers. There's no diapers also. So we really need some help.
More than 700 were killed in this weekend's earthquake, but the World Health Organization says that number will rise as communications improve. Argentina and Brazil are sending field hospitals and other supplies. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is bringing 20 satellite phones when she arrives later this morning. That's the first part of a much larger U.S. aid package. We'll get an update on the aftermath and answer your questions about the disaster later this hour.
In other news, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer says members of Congress voting in favor of overhauling health care will be more than willing to defend that plan to voters in the fall. He tells CBS News this morning.
We needed to provide access to affordable health care for all Americans and all families. That is the single best selling point.
Right now, the Democrats have the exact number of votes needed to trigger a process called reconciliation. For more on that controversial plan, we're joined by Julian Zelizer, a congressional historian at Princeton University. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
So it seems to me that, I was listening to Lamar Alexander there at the top of the hour talking about a kamikaze mission to ram this thing through using reconciliation. Are we distorting our view of the Constitution? Reconciliation is a simple majority, right?
Absolutely. For most of the history of the Senate, a majority was very frequently used to pass legislation. In the last 15 years, we now expect 60 votes on everything, and we get this argument that a majority is just ramming something through.
So it's not ramming?
No, not at all. Again, you had some legislation that was filibustered, others that wasn't. Now you have all legislation subject to the 60-vote bar, but it has nothing to do with the Constitution. It's a political argument that opponents are making. It's not a constitutional argument.
All right, Julian Zelizer, we're going to get behind that ram in just a moment. Stay with us.
They may be far apart on health care, but the Senate has reportedly reached a compromise on forming a consumer protection agency. It would oversee everything from credit cards to overdraft fees, and it would be part of the Federal Reserve.
In Savannah, Georgia, later today, the president will announce plans to pay up to $1,500 to anyone buying equipment to help their homes burn energy more efficiently. And after a decade of decline, a new government report shows teenage use of alcohol and marijuana is on the rise again. The Partnership for a Drug-Free America says the number of high schoolers who drink rose 11% last year. Overall, nearly 4 in 10 teenagers say they drink alcohol and or smoke marijuana. Asian markets are mixed. European indices are up at this hour. Futures are up right now. The Dow gets underway at 10,403 after a happy day yesterday. The S&P opens at 1,115, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,273. Coming up in this hour, how to tweak your resume if you're feeling like you're too much of an older worker. We offer some above-the-board advice later in the hour.
Age is just a number, right? Well, a lot of things are just a number. And some of them put things in its perspective, like the 1,000th American soldier killed in Operation Enduring Freedom. Some, like the 8.8 Chilean quake, help us understand disasters. When have numbers meant a lot to you? And do you think numbers are more helpful than words when telling a story? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're going to talk more about passing health care through reconciliation in a moment.
We are using the rules of the Senate here.
Reconciliation is one of the things that we need to look at.
The major package of health care reform cannot move through the reconciliation process.
An up or down vote is necessary.
It's a device which has never been used for this kind of major systemic reform.
Reconciliation has been used 21 times.
Do we start over from the beginning?
It's funny how when you put Carmina Burana behind their words, everything seems dramatic.
End of the world, yeah.
Yeah, it changes the meaning of what you're hearing. And you know,
Congress loves to do that.
They do. Yeah. They do. They take these words that we use in everyday life, and by the time it gets to Capitol Hill, it's totally changed. Pork.
Remember when it used to be just a source of protein?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. This is a tasty thing that you add ham at Christmas or something, or
parties with balloons
and cake.
Remember that?
That's right. Yeah. Reconciliation, it's a noun. It simply means the reestablishing of friendly relations. That's what reconciliation means.
No, it's a stake driven into the heart of democracy.
That's what it means now. Todd Zwillick is our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Celeste. How are
you?
So
reconciliation is a 36-year-old process. It was designed to avoid filibusters. It's been used almost 24 times. Why is reconciliation now a controversial stake in the heart of democracy?
I think it's controversial now because the process in health reform has become part of the story outside the Beltway, and that's unusual. You know, usually the Beltway worries about the process, and the rest of the country, if at all, worries about the substance. But healthcare itself is big and unwieldy and certainly controversial. The public's paying attention. There's an entire political movement, the Tea Party and aggrieved libertarians built up part of one of their planks is frustration over inside deals in Washington. And reconciliation maybe smacks of that because, like you said, you can do it with 51 votes, not the normal 60.
Okay, now it's being painted as the Republicans versus the Democrats here, but it's been reversed that way. Let me play you this clip from Republican Senator Judd Gregg. This is him speaking on the Senate floor in 2005.
We are using the rules of the Senate here. That's what they are, Senator. The fact is that all this rule of the Senate does is allow a majority of the Senate to take a position and pass a piece of legislation. Now, is there something wrong with majority rules? I don't think so.
Okay, so Senator Judd Gregg, perfectly fine with reconciliation when majority rules meant that the majority was the Republicans.
Right, and I think you've seen this throughout the recent history of the Senate. Reconciliation is something that's championed, by a frustrated majority, and we have a frustrated Democratic majority right now, and it's railed against by an oppressed and aggrieved minority. And the shoe was on the other foot back in 2005. The shoe has been on the other foot before. That was Judd Gregg in 2005 when he was chairman of the Budget Committee. So it's true he was fine with reconciliation then. Republicans say health reform is a little bit different because of the size and the sweeping nature of it. And they may have a point that when reconciliation was invented, it was never intended for broad policy changes like health reform. But the rules take care of that. You can't just take health reform, the big health reform bill, and plop it into reconciliation. You can't do that. You got to break it up into little pieces that fit under the rules that affect revenue. So saying the broad policy was never meant for reconciliation, the rules kind of cover that.
Okay, that's Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Let's go back to what this was historically intended for with Julian Zelizer. He's a congressional historian at Princeton. He's also author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Good morning, Julian.
Good morning again.
So, again, as Todd said, reconciliation had a fairly narrow purpose when it was created in 1974 as part of the Congressional Budget Act. Are we going off the rails when we try to use it for health care reform?
No, because what's happened since then is Congress has used it for other things. They gradually expanded what the purposes of that process are, and we've used it, in fact, on health care many times, on our children's health program that we have,
S-chip.
On the COBRA program. So we've actually broadened it. And as he said, there are rules that this will have to go through, which will determine is this too big or not. All it is a procedure. It's not different than the filibuster.
Okay, well, you're talking about a rule, and one that we've heard a lot about is the Byrd rule. I want to play you a clip from Senator Kent Conrad. He was the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee on, and he was speaking on Face the Nation this past Sunday. Here's what he had to say.
The major package of health care reform cannot move through the reconciliation process. It will not work.
It will not work
because of the Byrd rule, which says anything that doesn't score for budget purposes has to be eliminated.
Anything that does not score for budget purposes, Julian Zelizer, has to be eliminated.
Well, look, that is true. I mean, Senator Byrd put those rules in, or he got the Senate to accept the rules in 1985 and 1986. And all the provisions they put through will be put, I think there's six rules about how it affects the budget now, how it affects it in the next 10 years. So as Democrats put this reconciliation package together, they're going to have to show that it doesn't affect the budget in ways that violate the rules. So that is true, but they've already, you know, thought of that. In the end, health care, they argue, is a deficit measure. That's the only way we're going to curb Medicare spending. That's the only way we're going to curb health care spending is through reforming this extraordinarily expensive system.
It sounds like there's total latitude here, that if Julian, you and I sit down and we talk a little bit about Congress, we can expense the lunch, right, because we talked about work.
Oh, absolutely. The reason that the Senate puts these rules is to try to create some kind of playing field. But the rules are subject to interpretation, and there's really heated political battles over what the rules are and kind of what fits in. This is not new to health care. So I think there is room for this to work. It's the same way, again, the filibuster is being used in ways it was not originally used, and both Republicans and Democrats have been very flexible, especially in this idea you can just filibuster everything. So reconciliation is not different.
So, you know, to go back to John's point earlier this hour, in whether or not we're kind of distorting the original intent of the function of our government, was reconciliation intended when it was created in 74 to be effective? It was created as an effectiveness tool?
Oh, absolutely. Part of it was to deal with the problems we deal with today. Because it's such a wide-open institution with so many voices, here's a mechanism to allow majorities in the Senate to operate efficiently in dealing with the big problems of the day. One of the first presidents to use it was Ronald Reagan in 1981.
Okay, so majority rules in the Senate, right, Julian?
Absolutely.
Julian Zelizer, congressional historian at Princeton. He's the author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. We also spoke with Todd Zwillick, who's the Takeaway's Washington correspondent.
Barack Obama's administration, his health care reform package, saved by a Ronald Reagan initiative. There's bipartisanship.
You'll find bipartisanship anywhere, John Hockenberry. Now let's check in on the headlines at 15 minutes past the hour.
A Senate panel will grill top Toyota executives today about recent widespread safety issues. It's the third hearing in the past week on whether Toyota and federal safety regulators acted quickly enough. In coastal towns in Chile, a powerful aftershock has sent people running into the hills, fearing a repeat of the tsunami triggered by the earthquake on Saturday. Meanwhile, Chileans have been telling the BBC what life is like following the quake. Here's a man named Pablo in the capital, Santiago.
The old part of every town within Santiago City, they're all destroyed. They're all adobe-built houses. Adobe is a type of mud and straw. The roofs have come down, and so people either are sleeping on the street or wherever they can find family.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is due to arrive in the Capitol this morning, bringing equipment that will make up some of the U.S. aid for the country.
Senate negotiators are close to creating a new agency to oversee consumer financial products like credit cards and mortgages. The agency would be part of the Federal Reserve, and it would be able to write rules to protect consumers. And lawmakers in at least 16 states, from South Carolina to Oregon, have proposed outlawing credit checks for job applicants. They say the practice traps people in debt by keeping them out of work. Employers say the checks offer information about an applicant's sense of responsibility. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, what's in a number? 60 votes, 1,000 American soldiers dead in Operation Enduring Freedom as of yesterday. We're going to look at how important numbers are. The mother of one of those soldiers joins us with her story to kind of put the digits in perspective.
morning, everyone. A number story now. The simple way of saying it would be just add a zero. As of yesterday afternoon, when the Pentagon announced that 27-year-old Staff Sergeant William S. Ricketts was killed when his unit came under fire from insurgents in Afghanistan, the number of men and women killed in action in Operation Enduring Freedom, which has largely been fought in Afghanistan, went from 999 to 1,000. Add a zero, you get 1,000. Numbers are milestones. Lines, in geometry anyway, are sets of points in sequence. And as you look at those individual points on a line, they become infinite, uncountable details. 1,000 dead is a milestone. The fact that Staff Sergeant Ricketts was from Corinth, Mississippi, is one of those infinite details. Corinth's city motto, did you know this? History is only half our story. Another detail, another infinite point on the line. 21-year-old Corporal Matthew A. Cummins. That's another point on the line. He was lost in Enduring Freedom back in 2002. Another human detail, his mother's name, Pat Merrick, who joins us now. Pat, good morning.
Good morning.
And Pat, you have mourned the loss of your 21-year-old son since 2002, right?
That is correct. And this week is the anniversary of 8 years that he's been killed.
And certainly we mourn your loss in our small way with you, but help us to understand, what does the increasing count of dead in Operation Enduring Freedom mean to families such as yours, and a milestone like 1,000? How is that meaningful?
1,000 basically to me doesn't mean anything, but technically every death, every time I hear of a death, all I could feel is the loss that the other parents feel and the other families feel. And basically, it's the same feeling each time. And I tend not to watch the news or listen to it because it's painful. And I can just feel exactly what each parent is feeling. And so, I tend, just because of that, to stay away from it. I guess ignoring helps me.
Pat Merrick, when we've talked to you and families such as yourself in the past, a lot of concern was that Afghanistan was the forgotten war. Does the rising death toll and the increasing number of casualties put this more in the attention span of Americans who often tune out of the military experience?
Well, certainly that would. And yes, at one point in time, I felt like it was the forgotten war, but now it is no longer the forgotten war. But it doesn't matter whether the war is a forgotten war or not. It doesn't take away from the fact that we've lost many soldiers.
And your son was one of the first U.S. combat-related casualties. What did that mean, and how did the media and your relatives and friends approach you?
Well, with regard to media, it was a huge media blitz. I know that the entire time that his body was being flown back from Afghanistan, there were media just everywhere. Back then, I was living in Washington, D.C., and the front yard was just covered with media people interviewing us and so forth. So it was pretty huge. The soldiers that died during that battle, the media was huge for all of our families, and the funerals were on the air. I mean, everybody, CNN was there, Fox
sure.
News was there, everybody
yeah.
was there. So it was a huge, huge media blitz for following their death from start to finish.
Now, I suspect that the family of Staff Sergeant William Ricketts, the number 1,000 in Enduring Freedom, will not have the media on their lawns. And I'm wondering
That's
if...
That's probably correct. It's maybe local media, but
right.
it won't be international or national media.
Is that because of the number? Is that because America's moved on? Is that because maybe the family should be spared?
Well, most likely it's probably because Americans are becoming more hardened. You know, we hear, just as you and I hear every single day, that somebody's been lost in Afghanistan or Iraq, and it just becomes everyday news, which is, it's unfortunate, it truly is, because every one of those soldiers who has died is a hero, everyone.
And it has all sorts of details about their lives, memories, pictures, which I'm sure are floating through your mind even now, right?
Yes. I mean, I try to keep up, and I, at first, right after my son died, I tended to try to call individuals, and I wrote to every single one of the families, trying if I could get their address, and just trying to stay in touch with them, but it became too difficult. Oh. There were too many.
Sure.
And now I feel, sometimes I feel like a failure because I'm not able to communicate with those families and let them know, I know how you're feeling, I know where you are.
That's you couldn't possibly be a failure in that sense.
No.
It's an interesting
not
thought,
at all.
Though. And the idea that it's too many to handle, you know, it's like too many families to keep in touch with. Have you ever been to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial?
Oh, yes,
I
have.
You know, we talk about 1,000's too many, it sort of gets away from you, but when you look at those names, all the numbers of that 53,000 or so, it suddenly hits you. What is it?
And until you see those names on a memorial such as that, the impact doesn't reach you, I think. I mean, 1,000, we as humans, every single day, we hear about Congress passing, you know, trillion-dollar budgets. We hear all these numbers every single day, so numbers don't mean a whole lot until you actually can associate a body with that number.
Well, Pat Barrick, thanks for helping us to understand what 1,000 means on this tragic morning.
Well, my heart goes out to all the parents and especially to Staff Sergeant Ricketts' family.
Pat Merrick lost her 21-year-old son in Afghanistan in 2002. Coming up, looking at a cultural response to a natural disaster, the latest from Chile in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. The U.S. Postal Service is expected to propose a new service schedule today that will likely cut Saturday mail delivery. Other changes include closing some branches and expanding self-service kiosks. Postmaster General John Potter tells CBS News this morning the decision boils down to one thing.
The amount of mail that we deliver to every address per day is going down.
Post office is $10 billion in debt, and canceling Saturday deliveries would save $3 billion a year. It's getting to be a bit like Groundhog Day with Toyota, apparently. Our partner, the New York Times, is reporting that there are now complaints of sudden acceleration in Camrys, not included in the current recall. The Times says over the past decade, Toyota has had more complaints involving crashes than any other car maker in the U.S.
The polls in Texas are now open in the gubernatorial primary. Polls show incumbent Rick Perry with a lead over Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson. A day before the vote, Perry pardoned a man who died in jail after being wrongly convicted of rape. He's the first person in the state to be pardoned after death. The man, Tim Cole, had spent 13 years in prison when he died of an asthma attack in 1999. His mother tells the BBC,
"It's been 25 years. It will be March the 9th, and it's just been a roller coaster. It almost tore our family apart."
Another man confessed to the crime 2 years ago. And sad news from two different sides of the artistic spectrum. Barry Hanna, author of Geronimo Rex and High Lonesome, has passed away at his home in Oxford, Mississippi. He was 67 years old. And Guru, a lyricist from the pioneering hip-hop group Gang Starr, is in a coma after suffering from a heart attack over the weekend.
So many misconceptions. So many deceptions.
The 43-year-old, whose real name is Keith Elam, is also known for his work with jazz greats like Donald Byrd and Ramsey Lewis. Checking in on the markets now, Asian markets are mixed. European indices are up and futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 10,403, the S&P at 1,115, and the Nasdaq starts at 2,273. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
So go with me on this here. As we assess the numbers, 8.8 magnitude earthquake, more than 700 dead, the scale of the disaster in Chile. I was reminded yesterday of the words of Chilean author Roberto Bolaño, who writes about his land and the experience of the unexpected with deep wit and honesty and power, and I suspect maybe some comfort to the people of Chile right now. In By Night in Chile, written as he was dying, Bolaño said this, "I am dying now, but I still have many things to say. I used to be at peace with myself, quiet and at peace, but it all blew up unexpectedly." And yesterday, when we heard this voice on our program talk about the sound of the quake,
the earthquake itself was silent, and that was what was so eerie. I expected a roar, I expected a rumble. It was just silent, rocking earth.
Her voice reminded me again of Bolaño's words. One has a moral obligation to take responsibility for one's actions, and that includes one's words and one's silences, he wrote. Yes, silences, because silences rise to heaven and God hears them. At the end of his book and his life, Bolaño writes of his land. Sometimes the earth shakes, he says. The epicenter of the quake is somewhere in the north or the south, but I can hear the earth shaking. Sometimes I feel dizzy. Sometimes the quake goes on for longer than usual, and people take shelter in doorways or under stairs, or they rush out into the street. Is there a solution? We're joined now from Santiago by Jonathan Franklin, correspondent for The Washington Post, and also Dr. Arthur Lerner-Lamb, who's a seismologist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Laboratory. First, to Jonathan Franklin, good morning.
Good morning.
I suspect as you talk to people in Chile, they are asking in a much more concrete way, is there a solution to the devastation around them?
Yes, it's true there was silence at first, but now what you hear is kind of the roar of a million voices saying, where's the help? It's been 3 days now, and people are very desperate.
And, you know, we heard out of Haiti during the earthquake a sense of why Haiti, oh, now again, a sense that there's a cloud that hangs over the history of Haiti. There's a historical context to earthquakes in Chile. What are people saying to you?
Most people are saying, damn, that was huge. People are used to earthquakes here, right, but not like this.
And what is the most important issue right now in Santiago?
The most important issue in Santiago is actually organizing the aid and getting it south. The roads are just now being cleared. And southern Chile does not have major cities. Few areas are over 50 or 100,000 people. So we're talking of hundreds of little villages and towns. So it's a logistical nightmare when you think of trying to get fresh water to, say, 500 or 600 small communities.
Jonathan Franklin, correspondent for The Washington Post. Dr. Arthur Lerner-Lamb, a seismologist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Laboratory. Why is it that we seem to know very little about the onset of earthquakes and the dissipation of their energy? I'm reminded of the tsunami predictions that turned out in the Pacific to be not terribly severe at all.
Well, you know, when you talk about the tsunami predictions, actually, I think we did quite well. The severity of the tsunami, the height when it reaches land, is very difficult to predict, but the timing is very easy. And just using a precautionary principle, it pays to pay attention. But we'll get better at that.
But isn't there something spooky about waiting for the time for the waves to land? And then listen to this montage of news reports, predicting the worst, but then the waves came in and there was basically nothing.
They keep sounding the sirens to make sure everyone knows that the waves are on the way. The tsunami is coming.
Here in Honolulu, you should see something about 30 minutes from now.
Watching and waiting for the waves to appear.
So here we go. Things are officially beginning. We're getting underway.
I know you're a scientist, Dr. Arthur Lerner-Lamb, but it feels there like Mother Nature is holding back some cards.
Well, you know, one would also say that we're not listening to Mother Nature quite enough. This is a little bit of a wake-up call that these things can happen. Scientists may not have been able to predict the height of the tsunami when it reached Hawaii and other islands, but on the other hand, they warn people just in case. And wouldn't you be willing to take out that insurance, move to higher ground? It's a simple thing to do. And suppose it had been worse, what would we be saying now?
Now, as you look at some of the reports coming out of Santiago and Chile, I mean, this was a huge earthquake in terms of the amount of energy spent. Are you seeing that in the damage in the actual buildings?
Well, certainly this event was huge. It was among the top 10 earthquakes ever to be recorded by seismometers. But we're not seeing the extent of damage one would expect from such a large earthquake for two reasons. One, it's a bit offshore. But secondly, Chile has very advanced building codes, and when they were applied, the buildings did quite well in this earthquake.
So this idea, as I read there from Roberto Bolaño, that the notion of the earthquake, the land able to shake at any moment, being bound up in the culture, and makes its way into the building codes and is a form of preventive safety for the citizens.
Absolutely. This notion that there's a cultural response, that there's a cultural awareness of earthquakes, turns out to be important time and time again in society's ability to build resilience.
And Jonathan Franklin, one last question for you before we go. Any sense of the access to Concepcion, which is the closest large population center, to the actual epicenter of the quake offshore?
Two things, John. What we're seeing is that the Navy will start bringing in entire shiploads. That's going to be a lot easier than going by land. So a ship left last night loaded with all sorts of supplies. And second, on the damage in Chile, I think one thing is building codes, but I think Chile really shows that it has a democratic foundation now, because in a lot of countries you can have building codes and you have corrupt officials and stuff falls down. Chile has the building codes, but they also have a sense that this is important so that there isn't corruption. Building inspectors are not being bribed. I think it's really testament that in all of Santiago, not a single building over one story toppled.
Well, that's quite a legacy. We want to thank Jonathan Franklin, a correspondent for the Washington Post in Santiago, and Dr. Arthur Lerner Lamb, seismologist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. Thanks to both of you. Coming up in the hour, we're going to talk about work like we do every Tuesday, and unemployment has been especially hard for older workers. We've got some advice on tweaking resumes, all on the up and up, though, later on in the show.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. Well, they're calling it a Rosa Parks moment for Islamic women. Rosa Parks, of course, the African-American woman who refused to give up her bus seat on an Atlanta bus to a white passenger. Well, Fatima Thompson and three other women chose to pray in the men's section of a Washington, D.C. mosque this weekend. And my next guest says they set off on their own Islamic Rosa Parks moment. The whole thing was caught on tape. Here's a clip of the arrest. What you're hearing is a police officer speaking to Fatima Thompson.
Ms. Thompson, can I call you Ms. Thompson? The point is they're in charge. You're not. They have the point of, they've been appointed authority today. You can't protest inside time while they're praying.
He said you can't protest while they're praying. Fatima Thompson actually ended up getting arrested for praying in the men's section. Joining us now is Azra Nomani, author of Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Good morning.
Good morning.
So can you explain what exactly happened on Saturday? Fatima Thompson and three others decided to pray on the main floor of this mosque.
Yeah, you know, the Islamic Center of Washington sits in Embassy Row, in just a mile from the White House. And so Fatima Thompson is a convert to Islam from 18 years ago. And she and a few other local American Muslim women decided that they would walk through the gates of the mosque and pray in the main hall instead of the secluded corner where they're expected to sit behind a 7-foot wall partition. They did their prayer, and then unbeknownst to them and unbeknownst to these visitors that came, they became a larger group because there was a tour group that arrived. And women joined their line, not knowing that they were joining this protest. The men of the mosque, the officials got angry because late arriving men had to pray behind the women. And to many of them, that was just unacceptable. So they called the police, and the police arrived. Fatima Thompson and her co-protesters were told that they would be arrested if they stayed there. And they weren't actually arrested, but because they decided that then they would leave.
So is it not the right of a religion that believes, according to the tenets of the faith, that the men and the women should pray separately? Isn't that the right of the religious faith?
Yeah, and that's exactly, to me, the question that we face as a nation, because we have decided as a nation that freedom of religion does trump gender rights in America. And we have not made the same conclusion regarding racial discrimination, though. We have decided that a place of worship cannot racially discriminate against another person. So if Fatima arrived at the mosque and was told that she had to sit in a corner because she was African-American or she was Hispanic or any other race that was discriminated against, that would be unacceptable. But right now, yes, you're right, places of worship can discriminate based on gender.
Do you imagine that this is going to become a larger bone of contention?
We're in the midst of a gender jihad, a struggle for the rights of women, and I hope that in America we can be a leader for the world, and I firmly believe that we can.
One last question for you. When we hear the word protest, we imagine shouting. Were they disrupting the prayer service?
They weren't. They were peaceful, and they were part of the prayer service.
Okay, Azra Nomani is the author of Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. She is talking about Fatima Thompson, three other women who were removed from a Washington, D.C. mosque when they were praying in the men's section of the mosque.
Good morning, John Huckmere here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up in our work segment, do older workers need younger-looking resumes if they're trying to get a new job? Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Days after that powerful earthquake and tsunami devastated parts of Chile, authorities there are still trying to reach victims. Many people have been sleeping outside with little food or water. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has arrived in Chile and will meet with the president, Michelle Bachelet, in the capital, Santiago, today. In Afghanistan, the government has announced a ban on live media coverage of militant attacks. The government says broadcasts bolster the Taliban. It's not clear how it will be enforced, though.
The U.S. Postal Service is expected to propose a new service schedule today. It will likely cut Saturday mail delivery. Other changes include closing some branches and expanding self-service kiosks. We've got Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick with us for the details. Todd, is it budgetary concerns that are causing the post office to cut Saturday deliveries?
Budgetary, Celeste. And the bottom line is not good for the post office. They posted about a $4 billion loss in 2009. Their total debt is about $10 billion. The post office, contrary to popular belief, doesn't get taxpayer revenue. They operate like a business on the revenue side, but unlike a business, they're not allowed to close post offices that don't perform well, because if you lived in an area that was, you know, that didn't make a lot of money, you wouldn't be well served. And the point of the post office is to serve everyone. So they take in money, but they can't cut costs the way other people do.
But the post office argument is that people just are not sending as much mail anymore because they're using email and text message and Twitter and everything else.
It's the internet age. So yes, people are preferring to pay their bills online, do a lot of their banking online, things that they would have ordinarily turned to the post office to do. Snowstorms in Washington might have helped. You know, some of the postal workers didn't show up at our house during the snowstorm, so maybe they saved some money there.
Okay, Todd Zwillick's the Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
Well, if you're unemployed, being welcomed to the work week is probably unwelcome. You wait for calls back. You hope that someone will pay attention to your resume. Unemployment has spared no community in the past few years, but it's certainly been hard on mature workers. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, job seekers over 45 make up a disproportionate percentage of the long-term unemployed population. Now, is that because they're greater in numbers? Is that because there's something about being old? There's something about the number 45, which says that you're over the hill? In many cases, older workers never even get asked in for an interview. If you're over 45 and applying for a job, how do you avoid getting your resume tossed in the trash and increase your chances of getting your foot in the door? We want to hear your advice. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. But to get the conversation going, we've got Beth Kobliner, Takeaway Work contributor, right here in the studio. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
And Kat Brown used to be a materials buyer for an automotive supplier. And Kat, you've been out of work for nearly 4 years now?
I have. It's almost a little embarrassing to admit that, but yes, it's going on 4 years.
You just don't even think about being embarrassed admitting that on our program this morning. But do you think your age has anything to do with it? And what do you do to change that, to project that maybe you're younger, if not in age, in spirit?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I do feel my age has something to do with it, and it came as sort of a shock to me when I started my job search. I was downsized when I was 55 and did not even think that I wouldn't be able to walk into another position fairly quickly. So it was a very big surprise to me, and suddenly I started thinking, well, there's really only one reason that I'm being held back here that I can see. And I even ran into employers that, when I did get an interview, were blunt enough to say, well, I'm sorry, we're looking for someone younger.
Wow.
And I'm fortunate enough, I'm told I don't look my age. But I'll tell you what, if you've got any crow's feet at all nowadays, it gets a little scary out there.
Oh, man. Well, so, let's turn this over to Beth Kobliner. Whatever happened to experienced only need apply? That's what I used to see when I was applying for jobs back in the 70s.
Right. Well, we're finding that, you know, having lots of experience, and at least having lots of experience and putting it on your resume, could actually work against you in many situations. You know, no matter how you slice it, you look at all the statistics, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they consider 27 weeks or longer, an example of long-term out-of-workness. You know, if you're out of work
right.
for 27, that's a long period. Well, workers who are age 45 and older, they make up 32% of the unemployed. But when you look at that long-term period of unemployedness, they make up 38% of
wow.
that period.
Oh, that's huge.
So a lot of people, and there's one study that came out by the nonprofit Experience Works, found that people over 55 are out of work on average for about a year or more.
Oh, that's
so it's a long period. And once you get a job, if you get a job, you take a bigger pay cut. And it's, you know, very tricky for people to get back into the work world.
But Beth, what is the justification on the employer's end? What are they getting out of hiring younger people instead of the older workers?
They claim it costs much more for healthcare for older people, and they're afraid that older people have more trouble learning new technologies and new ways about the workplace.
Those are legal rationales?
They're not legal rationales, but it's very hard. I spoke to somebody at the AARP who said it's extremely difficult in a hiring situation to prove that a potential employer isn't hiring you because of your age.
Well, our friend Kat Brown raised the crow's feet issue, didn't you, Kat? Right?
Yes, I did.
So who came up with this notion of Botoxing your resume? Is that something you coined, Beth?
Actually, it's your wonderful people here at The Takeaway, but we were talking about, you know, how do you present yourself in a way that doesn't feel slimy to you? I mean, you don't sort of put a picture of yourself in a miniskirt on your resume, but how do you...
I would never do that.
Especially, yeah. But I didn't want to say that, John, but yeah, not a good look. But I think that it's very important for people to think about ways to present themselves, you know, very simple things like always email, never mail in your resume. Mailing in your resume is a clue that you're older. Have an email address. This is one that a friend told me, a Gmail address rather than an AOL address, because that's just a signal that you're young.
What's your email address server, Kat?
My server is gmail.com.
There, you're hip.
One page resume, no cover letter. Just, you know, an attachment to a quick short note, email, basically message. Boom, you're done. Emphasize the relevant experience. I don't know how many years you put on your resume, Kat, because a lot of people say, you know, don't put on every single experience you've had. Keep it short. Only say the last 15 years, maybe even last 10 years. So you're doing all that.
I'm doing all that. I had to learn as I went along, though.
Mm.
And at one point, when I lived in a very small town in northern Michigan where everyone knew me, number one. Most people knew what year I graduated from high school.
Mm.
More than willing to take any lower-level job just to pay the bills. You can't get hired for those. You're overqualified. You're told that time and time again. So I started, I call it de-emphasizing my accomplishments on my resume. And I actually wound up with a trio of resumes, and I affectionately refer to them as Dumb, Dumber, and Dumbest, to try and get those lower, and still couldn't.
Well, that's frustrating. I mean, unfortunately, we got to move on. But Kat Brown, good luck to you. We want to check in and see if Dumb, Dumber, or Dumbest actually scores for you. Good luck to you now.
Thank you so much.
Kat Brown used to be a materials buyer for an automotive supplier. She's been out of work for nearly 4 years, and you can hear there she's got three different versions of her resume and is looking, despite her age, for another job. Of course, Beth Koblenner, Takeaway Work Contributor, thanks to both of you. So does your resume need a little tightening under the eyes? Beth's put together a list of 5 ways to Botox your resume. You can check out her suggestions at thetakeaway.org. Just click on blog.
While age is just a number, sometimes it means something more.
Out of Chile, an 8.8 magnitude earthquake striking early this morning.
Canada now has 13 gold medals, easily the most.
NATO forces say 16 Afghan civilians have died in the Marja fighting, along with 13 NATO troops and 120 insurgents.
525,000 moments.
And as of yesterday, the 1,000th American soldier has died in Operation
Numbers,
Enduring Freedom.
Numbers, numbers.
We as humans, every single day, we hear about Congress passing, you know, trillion-dollar budgets. We hear all these numbers every single day. So numbers don't mean a whole lot until you actually can associate a body with that number.
That's Pat Merrick, whose son was one of the 1,000 soldiers lost in Operation Enduring Freedom. What numbers have meant a lot to you, not just in news, but throughout your life? And are numbers, do you think, clearer than words? Valerie in Massachusetts tells us, while numbers can quickly communicate a story, it's in the way they're presented that makes them tricky. Often numbers are couched in words, and the story comes in a careful reading of the words in order to correctly interpret the number. My take is that numbers and words, equally important. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. And there's a special number for us here at The Takeaway, 1. That's how much our family just grew. Our amazing producer, Sitar Nieves, just welcomed a baby boy into the world yesterday. Congratulations to her and her husband, Mark. We don't know what the name of the little baby bouncing baby boy is.
Baby X.
Right. If you have a name suggestion, that's something you can call us about, 877-8-MY-TAKE. We have a number of suggestions coming out of the control room. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. Ajax is taken. This is The Takeaway.
Chileans in Concepcion plead for water and for police protection.
Ayuda, ayuda, eso necesitamos agua, ayuda. Que venga, venga la policía, seguridad, seguridad.
The earthquake in Chile was 8.8 magnitude. 700 people died. The Haitian earthquake was 7.0 and 230,000 were killed. Two countries, two earthquakes, significantly different results. Why?
Our building standards were strengthened over the past decades, and so you have a population that clearly was very well prepared.
A spokesman from the U.S. State Department, can we learn from Chile? Are we as prepared as they were? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, March 2nd, and The Takeaway is that some things you can prepare for and some things you can't.
Yes, indeed, and we're seeing that unfolding in the top story we're following this morning. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has arrived in Chile in the past 15 minutes to offer earthquake assistance to the people of Chile. She's brought 20 satellite phones with her, just a small part of a much larger U.S. aid package. The death toll from this weekend's earthquake stands at over 700, with the number likely to rise as communications improve in the hard-hit coastal areas. Earlier, we spoke with Jonathan Franklin, who's with the Washington Post in Santiago.
Sure, there was silence at first, but now what you hear is kind of the roar of a million voices saying, where's the help?
Where's the help? It's arriving today, with Argentina and Brazil both sending field hospitals and other supplies.
For the latest this morning, we're joined by Pascal Bonafoy, a correspondent for the Global Post in Santiago, Chile. Pascal, other people are saying that Chile was very well prepared for this earthquake. Do you think the people of Chile feel that they were fully prepared for it?
I think we all felt we were really prepared for it, but events proved it differently.
What do you mean?
Well, in relation to earthquakes like in Haiti, of course, Chile was much more prepared. But there were major flaws also in the reaction. One was the Navy, which right after the earthquake said there was no risk of tsunami or tidal waves. And in fact, the whole coast was wiped out by tsunamis. And secondly, we're 3 days, this is the fourth day after the earthquake, and the food is just arriving this morning, and not everywhere. The water has been arriving partially. You see the Chilean government sent help to Haiti immediately, but it wasn't able to send help immediately to its own population in the south.
We're going to talk more about what was and was not able to do. Pascal Bonafoy, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
The U.S. Postal Service wants to stop mail deliveries on Saturday. The agency will submit a formal request by the end of the month to Congress to reduce its mail deliveries from 6 days a week to five. Postmaster General John Potter tells CBS News this morning the reason is simple.
Any paper-based communication is being challenged by how they exist and how they provide their service in an internet world.
The post office is $10 billion in debt. Canceling Saturday deliveries would save $3 billion a year. Meanwhile, President Obama is expected to explain his revised proposal for passing health care reform tomorrow. This comes as a survey by the Associated Press suggests House Democrats have enough votes to trigger a process called reconciliation to pass a health care bill with a simple majority.
Looking at the markets, Asian markets are mixed. European indices are up. Futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 10,403, the S&P at 1,115, and the NASDAQ at 2,273. Well, we're celebrating an anniversary today, the 45th anniversary of the release of Sound of Music, a movie that continues to endure.
45 is a number. Sometimes numbers mean more. In today's news, there's the 1,000th American soldier dead in enduring freedom. What do you think words mean? Are they clearer than numbers?
Good morning, Troy from North Dakota. I think our obsession with numbers in the Western world is unhealthy, and I think we're fooling ourselves to think that we can put everything in a box. Be more qualitative than quantitative in your own thoughts, and you'll enjoy life more.
We'll talk about the numbers. Reality by the numbers on The Takeaway. Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Coming up, The latest from the Chilean quake in a few minutes.
We're following the aftermaths of the 8.8 earthquake that rocked Chile over the weekend, and we've been getting your personal reactions to the disaster.
This is Bill from Oklahoma City. I have worked with Chilean people, including engineers, and have been very impressed with them. Of all the countries in Latin America, Chile is probably the best equipped to handle a crisis like this. Very progressive country.
Obviously, if you have a personal take on the earthquake in Chile, you can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But we're joined now again by Pascal Bonifoy, correspondent for the Global Post in Chile, who said that Chile in some ways was well prepared and in some ways was not. Pascal, can you give us details on how things stand in Chile right now? Has food and water begun to trickle in?
Was just beginning. The government just sent the first rations and they're being distributed as of today, actually. But we're now into the fourth day. Water has been distributed, but partially it's there's still a lot of need for water and food because people lost everything they had in their homes. Supermarkets have been completely depleted by looting, so really people had nothing to eat. So just now they're starting to receive food.
We heard a lot of reports of what they were calling looting. They instituted some curfews, and there was talk that they might have to institute martial law as well. Is there violence?
Well, there has been quite a bit in Concepcion and other cities down south. Last night, the curfew was extended. The first night it was between 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. Last night it was from 8 p.m. to noon, and people in Concepcion still can't leave their houses until noontime. And apparently, what I've been hearing reports this morning, it's been pretty calm. There's been intense attempts at looting, but it's really subsided in compared to the previous day.
Okay, and what does it look like when you look around? How bad is the devastation? If you see five houses in a row, are two of them gone? Have they mostly stood up?
It depends. I mean, in upper areas, hillsides, in some cities and towns were better. Are in better standing because they weren't wiped away by tidal waves.
Right.
Cities, there's construction that's been destroyed, neighborhoods destroyed, but then there have been complete fishing hamlets and coves and small towns that have been completely obliterated by the tidal wave, partially the earthquake and then the tidal wave. And these people are in shelters or up in hills or at relatives' homes, and they've got nothing. They don't even have anywhere to go home to.
Hey, Pascal Bonifoy is a correspondent for the Global Post in Chile. She actually joined us from Santiago. And we're joined now by John Christian. He's an independent consultant, geotechnical and earthquake engineer. John, you've heard a lot of talk about how well-prepared Chile was and that they're used to earthquakes, and so they built to survive this kind of thing. In what ways is that true? How did they build for it?
Well, first place, Chile is a very modern society, and their engineers are very good. They're well known around the world. And what it has to do with the materials you build out of, the kind of structural details you make, how you design the buildings, how you analyze them. There's a whole discipline of designing buildings to behave well during earthquakes.
I knew this well because I grew up in California, and we even were taught in school about rolling buildings, constructing buildings.
That's a retrofit technique, basically. What happens when you have a building like the state capitol that you really don't want to tear down, but on the other hand, it's not really up to date, so you do something to separate it from its foundation.
To make it roll, yeah, so that it doesn't get destroyed. But, you know, we often think in the States that we have the latest in technology in these kind of things, and then we look at Chile and we have to ask ourselves, could we learn something from this other country?
Oh, absolutely. Look, as far as the technical capacity of the country, and particularly in earthquake engineering, I don't think the people in California who are our leaders in this field would think the Chileans ought to take a back seat to them. They recognize them as very, very world-class people. However, in any earthquake, particularly an earthquake of this size, you learn something. Something always goes wrong. And so always you have to go out and find out what went wrong and fix it. That has been one of the strengths of the earthquake engineering field, that they have a long-standing policy dating back, I think, to around 1930s, the Long Beach earthquake, of actually going out and investigating what happened during an earthquake, writing reports on it, and then using that to amend the codes, the policies, procedures, and so forth. And I'm sure this will happen here in Chile.
You know, I myself am not all too badly concerned about California, because this is a place that's been dealing with earthquakes for a very long time. And I can say from personal experience that the people there are not generally going to panic unless it's a massive, massive earthquake. But are there other places in the United States that perhaps are not as well prepared for an earthquake?
Yes, there are. Personally, a comment about your situation in California. Everything you just said, you could have said about Chile two or three days ago. If there were a very large earthquake in some part of California, I think you would find in the first couple of days that there would be some things that would not work. I'm not blaming people in California. I'm simply saying that we live in an imperfect world. Now, as to the other places that have a problem, first, the people in the Pacific Northwest, the Oregon, Washington, Seattle area, have over the last maybe decade or two decades discovered that they are exposed to a much higher level of seismic hazard than they thought they were. And this has had a big impact on their codes, and obviously means that a lot of their stuff is not built to more modern codes. More to the point, I think there are places like Memphis and St. Louis where not only is there historical reason to believe that there could be very large earthquakes, but in many cases, people are actively resistant to doing something about it.
They don't want to tear down the historic buildings?
No, I don't mean tear down the historic buildings. I mean actually improve building codes and things like that.
Oh, because of the cost, perhaps?
Sure.
Okay. John Christian is an independent consultant, a geotechnical engineer, and an earthquake engineer. He joined us from Massachusetts. We also spoke with Pascal Bonifoy, a correspondent for the Global Post in Chile. She joined us from Santiago, Chile, and we will, of course, be bringing you updates from the aftermath of the earthquake in Chile as the morning progresses.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in now on the headlines.
A Senate panel is going to get another piece of Toyota today, grilling top company officials about the worldwide recall of 8.5 million vehicles, the third such congressional hearing in 7 days. Meanwhile, General Motors says it's recalling more than 1 million cars to fix power steering motors that can fail. GM says the vehicles are safe to drive. The cars never lose steering, but may be harder to steer when traveling slowly.
The First Lady has made further comments about the health of America's children. At an annual meeting of the School Nutrition Association yesterday, she said child obesity is everyone's responsibility.
We have to be honest. Our kids didn't do this to themselves. You see, our kids don't decide what to serve or what is sold at lunch.
Those comments by the First Lady come as America learns the president himself may have trouble resisting a cheeseburger or cupcake. His doctor recommended that the president lower his cholesterol, which has spiked in the last few years. And finally, in order to hear this, you may now have to pass a special sort of breathalyzer. There's a device installed in the cars of first-time drunk driving offenders that will not allow the engine to start until the driver successfully breathes into the gadget. Cities in Maryland and Virginia are the latest to try them. They're following the lead of 12 other states who already use them. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up,
you're about to enter the exciting world of mobile animated display.
That's exciting.
It is, actually, but mobile animated display, maybe the person looking at the display is the one who's mobile. New York Times finance reporter Louise Story tells us about the dangers posed by digital billboards.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first takeout is on business with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner in the New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Morning.
It turns out that distracted driving is actually a business story. Listen.
You're about to enter the exciting world of mobile animated display. We taken the concept of billboard advertising and made it come alive with lights and sound and movement. Animated messages move across our mobile billboards in a way that demands attention and promises to change the world of advertising forever.
Great for advertisers, but perhaps not so much for drivers. The series in the New York Times called Driven to Distraction is all talking about the growth of this animated digital advertising on roads across America. What have you found?
So they are growing. Digital billboards, some people are calling them, you know, like internet on a stick. The companies that are the companies that are distributing these, even one of them, Lamar Advertising, that's a huge advertising company, they proudly said, you know, this is like a slide projector. And if you think about it, all day long when we walk around now, we see TV screens everywhere. We see them in the elevators we go. We see them in the shopping malls, the airplanes.
Bus shelters.
Yes, everywhere. But the problem is, alongside the highway, there are some real safety concerns. The Federal Highway Administration is looking at this. They're planning an eye-tracking study for the summer where they're actually going to install cameras in people's cars to see if their eyes stray extra long to look at these digital billboards.
How would they set the standard? I mean, the number there must be a little tough because, I mean, advertisements are supposed to distract you.
That's right. But, you know, since the 60s, if you remember, there were some big beautification efforts of the highway system in the 1960s.
Sure.
They capped the number of billboards at 450,000. And this has been this thing
that
reigned in advertising. Yes, for decades, you know, advertisers couldn't really up the ante on roadside advertising. And what these digital billboards allow advertisers to do is up the ante. There's about 2,000 of them now. Some people think it may become 10% of the signs on the highway eventually. And each sign can feature ads from, you know, 10 different advertisers. Cycle them through the day, show you coffee advertisements in the morning, beer advertisements in the night, you know. And so what they do is it really allows advertising to take the next level. The question is it safe?
They could read your license plate and figure out if you need to pay your credit card bill
and put that on the billboard. Oh, that'd be pleasant, right?
You know, just before you go, Louise, you know, we've been talking about numbers all morning on the program. You do this as a matter of living. You look at numbers on balance sheets and economic statistics, and you have to make those numbers tell a story. How do you do that?
Well, you usually look for numbers to move in a direction. And what's actually been very difficult about this recession is so many different trending statistics haven't trended. You know, the housing numbers keep pointing different ways, bumping up and down, but you look for a trend. The other thing about numbers that kind of fascinates me is I think that in so many ways it's what separates society. I mean, more money you have, that's a number. More IQ you have, that's a number. We looked at percentiles, you know. So numbers actually often divide people. And, you know, when you improve society, it's often when you're moving the numbers around.
Well, numbers divide. Coming together is not a matter of numbers. It's a matter of humanity.
Well, you know, we're going to go to the next person here who also deals with numbers all the time, and that's Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. And the numbers are definitely trending in favor of UConn. Not that there's any surprise that UConn is doing well at basketball, but the UConn women seem to be, even more so than usual, dominating college basketball for women.
It's true. Last night they beat Notre Dame 76-51 in South Bend to record their 69th win in a row, which means that they are one win away, which should happen this Sunday. They're one win away from tying a record that was set by the UConn women's team in 2001 and 2003 of having the most consecutive victories in women's college basketball.
So this school is about to break their own record.
They are about to. And on the tip of numbers, they're anchored by Tina Charles, who's their all-American, all-everything center. And she, last night, not only did they win, but she also passed the leading Nikisha Sales as the storied program's leading scorer with 2,184 points. And she passed Rebecca Lobo as the leading rebounder with 1,273 rebounds. So this is not only is it they're getting consecutive wins, but they're also breaking records along the way.
Now, how are the men's basketball doing? Are they living up to the women?
Well, with UConn?
Yeah, with UConn.
Well, this year is not quite the best year for the UConn men's team, whereas a couple years ago they did a double. They had a dual championship. That's not going to happen this year. The UConn men aren't quite that good.
No. Okay, so who was doing well in men's basketball for college sports?
We touched on it yesterday. Syracuse is the best team in college basketball.
Well, and Kansas is number one, aren't they?
Kansas is not number one anymore. Syracuse has now been
number one.
Oh, really?
Ranked.
Oh, they did?
I thought
they were going to give them the
top
number
rank.
One even though they lost.
They're in the number one spot.
Wow.
And we were talking, and so Syracuse is interesting because what they do well is what a lot of teams don't do well. They have a very balanced attack. So they have a very good inside game and an outside game. And they're extremely deep. So they can pull two or three guys from the bench. If you look at their minutes.
Oh, a deep bench.
Exactly.
Right.
So if you look at the minutes that they're playing, they're pretty balanced across the team. So they have about seven or eight guys that play around the same amount of minutes. And all of those seven or eight guys can put up double figures at any given moment. So you never know who's going to really come through on any given day for Syracuse. That's why I like them. They play great defense. They have the 2-3 zone. They're really hard to score on. And they're playing really as a solid unit. So right now, in terms of college basketball, men's college basketball, they're definitely not as dominant as the UConn women. I don't think any team in history will be as dominant as this UConn women's team. But in terms of men's college basketball, this Syracuse team is the most balanced, the most feared team in college basketball.
And they don't have to worry about injuries, right? Because
they have a deep bench.
They have a deep bench.
I sense there's a backstory here with Ibrahim and Syracuse. Is there something going on here? You got a relative that goes to Syracuse?
Well, I have insider information,
Hawk.
I'm gushing a little bit because I love the Syracuse Orange. And, it's just like when the Yankees won the World Series this past year. It's amazing as a sports commentator to be able to talk about the best team in the land and they're your favorite team.
All right.
Okay. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our takeaway sports contributor. And we are following the numbers, not just in sports and money, but all over the place. The 1,000th American soldier has been killed in Operation Enduring Freedom. That's the war in Afghanistan. And 700 killed in the Chilean quake.
That number's
we're talking
rising.
About, yeah, absolutely. And we're talking about the power of numbers. When have numbers meant a lot to you? Not just in news events, but at any time. Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org.
How old are you? There's a number.
40.
Coming up, looking for a narrative in the numbers we see in the news all the time. That's coming up in just a few moments. But right now, there's plenty of numbers in the top news story we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Here's an eyewitness account from the coastal town of Pelhue in Chile of that tsunami that hit on Saturday. A resident says the tsunami came in three waves, surging 200 yards into town. He tells the AP he watched the wave drag away a bus full of tourists who'd hoped to make it to high ground. Rescue officials say only five bodies from the bus have been recovered from the more than 20 believed to be aboard. The death toll now stands at more than 700 from the Chilean earthquake. It's still expected to rise. In the city of Concepcion, the military curfew has been extended. We spoke to Pascal Bonifoy, a correspondent for Global Post in Santiago, who told us on top of the lack of basic necessities, the curfew is a growing problem as well.
The first night it was between 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. Last night it was from 8 p.m. to noon. And people in Concepcion still can't leave their houses until noontime.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is now on the ground in Santiago.
The U.S. Postal Service wants to stop delivering mail on Saturdays. The agency will submit a formal request by the end of the month to Congress. Postmaster General John Potter tells CBS News this morning the decision boils down to one thing.
The amount of mail that we deliver to every address per day is going down.
Post office is $10 billion in debt, and canceling Saturday deliveries would save $3 billion a year. Taking a look at the markets, they are now open. The Dow is up 18 points. The S&P is up 2 points, and the NASDAQ is up 6 points. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
Numbers, numbers, numbers. You know, there was a time when music was thought to be the dance of numbers. If Greek mathematician Pythagoras had written a symphony, it might have sounded like this modern Pythagoras symphony. Pythagoras, you see, thought that numbers were the tonal units of reality and that music and mathematics were the same. In our time, though, numbers and reality feel interchangeable quite a lot. 10% unemployment, 2% inflation, $1.7 trillion deficit, or the price of oil and pork bellies. That's the din at the pit at the New York Mercantile Exchange where they trade oil futures, screaming numbers that determine all kinds of things in our reality, prices of fuel, cost of medicines, chemicals, foods. Perhaps Pythagoras would think of that noise in this way.
Cotton up 45, 80. Cotton up 45, 90.
Orange. That's a piece by audio artist Ben Rubin. It's his sound portrait of how trading numbers interact with music and reality in a more artistic way. Are numbers as useful as they are pretty? Well, let's find out, and let's have a bit of a debate. With us, with differing views of how numbers communicate to all of us, are James Geary, a journalist and the author of Geary's Guide to the World's Greatest Aphorists. James Geary, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, John. Glad to be here.
And Kaiser Fung is the author of Numbers Rule Your World. He's in the studio. Kaiser, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
So we have varying views here. Do numbers distort or give us a sense of the scale of reality? Are they a help or a hindrance? Do you prefer numbers, Kaiser Fung?
Well, as the title of my book implies, I certainly think numbers have a very powerful way of conveying information. And but it's not all numbers. It's picking the right numbers and providing the context for people to interpret the numbers.
James Geary, words are better?
Well, yes, as an author and a journalist, I would say words are better. I think numbers are important, and I think especially today when some of the biggest issues facing us involve numbers. You know, the financial crisis, global warming, all those kind of things involve science and numbers, and that's crucial. But I don't think science touches the experience of people when they're dealing with these issues. For example, I used to live in Amsterdam, and I lived right around the corner from the Anne Frank House. And when you talk to people about the Holocaust, you can name some horrific numbers, the number of people who were murdered, for example. But going to that house, reading her diaries, seeing the little secret passageway that led to the rooms where she and her family were hiding, no number can replace that. And it's only by really confronting the words and the words that speak to that experience that you really feel the impact of that whole event.
Well, James Geary, that's one for you. Kaiser Fung, how does a number of the scale of, say, 6 million, we're referring to the Holocaust there, or 1.6 trillion in the case of the deficit, get infused with a human story that causes the number to resonate in a more human way? We've talked about the earthquake this morning. We're talking about the 1,000 dead in Afghanistan, the Operation Enduring Freedom.
Right. So I think the a good example is if you think about the deficit, and we these days are talking about the trillions and trillions of dollars. In 2008, James Fallows at The Atlantic actually wrote an article called the $1.4 trillion question about, you know, how the Chinese government is funding our debt. Now, it turns out that the online readers really loved this article and spread it around, but actually with a very different title. It was called Average American Owes Average Chinese $4,000.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, and you could tell if you pick the right numbers, it makes a big difference.
James Geary, let me take it back to you. I heard a number over the weekend that was pretty interesting. If you take, and this is more geometry rather than specific algebraic numbers, if you take the Earth and make it the size of a basketball, okay?
Okay, I'm following you so far.
And you suck all the water off the earth, it'll fit into a ping pong ball, okay?
Uh-huh.
And if you take the fresh water that's available on the earth, it fits on the head of a pin by that scale. Does that use of numbers give you a sense of how much fresh water we have on earth?
Yeah, but you've also completely lost me as well. I think those kind of analogies are useful, but I think as the previous speaker just said, for me, personalization is the key. So when you name a sort of big generic number like the total national debt, well, that really doesn't. I can't see. It's not immediately obvious how that affects me. But when you say I owe the average Chinese person $4,000, well, then I can understand what you're talking about, because then it's a personal story. It applies directly to my life. And I think especially with money, you know, not just the global financial crisis, but the personal financial crisis. If you say to somebody, if you don't save enough for retirement in 30 years, you're going to be really, really in a difficult situation. Well, that's one thing. But if you give them an example of someone who hasn't saved and who is in a really difficult situation, then the message gets home in a much more powerful way than if it was just a number.
It's the Aesop grasshopper and the ant story, right? Here's a response that we got. What's the importance of numbers? Are they more important than words? Here's one of our listeners.
Hi, this is Jim Barkley in Medford, Massachusetts. Numbers and words are equally important. As Norton Juster said in The Phantom Toll Booth, the kingdom of words and the kingdom of numbers had to learn to get along, because
you couldn't have tea for two without the tea.
Could you? But you wouldn't have
tea for two without the two.
Could you?
So, James Geary, we make it a tie here.
I could live with that.
Kaiser Fung, do you think people who use numbers a lot need to maybe use words to do what the title changer in James Fallows' article did, to humanize the issue of the deficit?
Absolutely. I think one of the reviewers of my book actually pointed this out, is that for a book that's called Numbers Real World, they are actually very few numbers, surprisingly, in the book. And that's because I needed to provide the context behind it.
All right, Kaiser Fung, author of Numbers Rule Your World, and James Geary, journalist, author of Geary's Guide to the World's Greatest Aphorists. Thanks to both of you. If you want to hear that musical composition based on the numbers from the stock market and the commodities exchange, we link it to our website, the Ben Rubin piece, takeaway.org. Coming up.
You are 16, going on 17, baby.
Two numbers right in order. Even in the Sound of Music, it's the, can you guess, the 45th anniversary of the movie. We talk with the grandson of Maria von Trapp and the voice you're hearing right now, Daniel Truitt, who played Rolf, Liesel's boyfriend, the one bad guy in the Sound of Music.
Yeah, but they had to create a bad guy.
That's true. You'll find out later this hour.
Cats will offer you food and wine. Totally
Oh, man.
That
sounds
nice.
Great, but it's a little early for spring, sadly. If it were springtime, our listener responses theme might be, based on a conversation we had yesterday on the program, it's called Returning to the Nest.
My name is Emily Sussman. I'm 30 years old, and I'm living with my parents, too, on Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
And we talked yesterday about the trend of adult children, you see, moving back with their parents. The AARP reports that about one-third of all 18 to 49-year-olds live at home. And we heard a bunch of stories like Emily's.
I'm a journalism student. I'm still finishing my master's, trying to do it long distance, and I'm living with my parents. And it's even worse than the woman who was on the air, because Cape Cod is mostly a retirement community, but they're very nice.
This is Julie from Norman, Oklahoma. I have a slightly different situation with my family. Both my mother and my mother-in-law moved in with me over the last 2 months. So it's two grandmas, my three-year-old daughter, and my husband and I, in a three-bedroom house with one bathroom. And when you add in the younger sister-in-law of mine, the talk becomes even more complicated in terms of the division of labor. 17-year-olds don't seem to be very interested in contributing to the household. Otherwise, it's been a great experience, and I recommend intergenerational living to everyone.
Talk about numbers. Three-year-old daughter, husband, and I in a three-bedroom house with
one bathroom.
One bathroom.
That's the number that shocks me.
Barb in our Denver, in Denver posts to our site, thetakeaway.org, this story. My parents made it clear that I could always return home if needed. I left home for college at 17 and returned for 2 months while looking for housing at age 27. It was such a gift. It allowed me to take some risks so I could follow my dreams.
But moving back in, not always that great. Laura also posted to the site, thetakeaway.org. My sister and her husband recently welcomed their unemployed adult child back into their home, and it's been a very difficult process for all of them. I don't see a single advantage beyond the obvious, a parent's feeling of responsibility to provide housing for a child in need, no matter what the age. My sister spent her life being a daughter, sister, mother, wife, with all the responsibilities. When her offspring flew from the nest and it was at last empty, she began to enjoy being somewhat independent, but in taking her adult child back into her home, she has once again assumed the mommy role.
Extended family, extended headache. But there is some advice we got for people like Laura's sister.
This is Alan in Somers. The secret to having a young person back in the house is not to make it a parent-child relationship, but to make it a landlord-tenant relationship. That allows the child not to feel infantilized, and it allows the parents to not feel that supportive.
You know how to reach us at thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And let's move on to a different kind of nest last night.
Good to be home, Kev. I'm Jay Leno, your host, at least for a while. So actually, we were off for the last couple
John.
Of weeks. Kind of like the Russians at the Olympics. Whoa, what happened to them? Yeah.
Jay's first night back at the Tonight Show. I know John Hockenberry was watching closely. He did get a warm welcome back from our listeners. Or maybe you were holding out, though, for Conan.
Hey, this is Matt from Myrtle's Inlet, South Carolina, and I'm voting for Conan O'Brien.
Definitely Conan O'Brien. Clever, witty, wonderful. Jay Leno, average, common, trite.
Takeaway listeners are with Coco.
That's the demo we want, babe. I'm telling you. Go with Coco.
We wish him well.
Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. And, you know, John, we're talking about numbers all morning long. How about this number, one?
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd lay.
Right, and then he met his goat herdess, right?
One
and then
is
it
the
became
loneliest
two.
Goat herd.
And yeah. Then, yeah, there's the mother-in-law that makes three. All right, you're
it's
going
beautiful.
With me here.
This is I love it.
It's also the 45th anniversary of The Sound of Music. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, let's take a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. In coastal towns in Chile, a powerful aftershock has sent people running into the hills, fearing a repeat of the tsunamis triggered by the earthquake on Saturday. Meanwhile, Chileans have been telling the BBC what life is like following the quake. Here's Pablo in the capital, Santiago.
The old part of every town within Santiago City, they're all destroyed. They're all adobe-built houses. Adobe is a type of mud and straw. The roofs have come down, and so people either are sleeping on the street or wherever they can find family.
This morning, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton arrived in the capital, Santiago, to offer the beginning of U.S. aid.
Voters in Texas head to the polls today to vote in the primary election for governor, which will probably be decisive. The Republican contest is heated. It's, in a sense, a battle of the incumbents. Incumbent Governor Rick Perry, who's vulnerable, been trying to fend off a challenge by Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson. Joining us now is Ben Philpott. Once again, he's covering the race for KUT News and the Texas Tribune. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
So any indication of turnout this morning?
You know, based on early voting, it looked like the numbers in the Republican primary were up about 2 to 3 times what they were in 2006. But then, of course, Governor Perry was running unopposed, and so there wasn't as much interest and TV commercials generated.
So is the Tea Party credential of Governor Perry likely to bring people to the polls? We've seen the sort of Tea Party hardcore conservative independent voter much more motivated than some of the traditional party line people.
That's right, and Governor Perry's done an excellent job of harvesting those voters. You know, way back in April last year, he went to Tea Party rallies. He made, you know, brief mention to Texas secession from the United States. He gained a lot of support there. There is actually a so-called Tea Party candidate also in the Republican primary. Deborah Medina has polled as high as, you know, the low 20s in some polls. We'll see what she can end up doing today on Election Day. No telling whether or not the Tea Party people are actually high in number or just very loud.
And Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson is, by some estimates, favored in this race, right?
If the estimates were taken last year, that's correct. She has had about a 10% to 20% gap below the governor for about the last 4 or 5 months. Governor Perry has painted her as a Washington insider, and it's Texas versus Washington all the time as far as his campaign is concerned, and Senator Hutchinson has never been able to shift the topic.
All right, well, we'll talk to you tomorrow. We'll see how it turns out tomorrow. Ben Philpott, reporter covering the governor's race for KUT News and the Texas Tribune there in Texas. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
The sound of music.
It's been 45 years since Julie Andrews first spun in her dress and apron around the hills of Austria.
You can
singing
still see
that.
The grass.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Everybody remembers that. And people forget oftentimes what a huge success that movie was. It won 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. And adjusted for inflation, get this, The Sound of Music, adjusted for inflation, earned more than $1 billion
not
at the box office.
Not a single avatar in the movie. Not one computer-generated effect.
Not one thing. Here to talk about the enduring appeal of this movie, The Sound of Music, two people whose lives were profoundly affected by it. Sam Von Trapp is a grandson of the real-life Maria Von Trapp, and he also runs the Trapp Family Lodge alongside his father and sister that's in Vermont. And we're also joined by Dan O'Truitt, who sang and danced as Liesl Von Trapp's Nazi turncoat boyfriend, Rolf. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Sam, let's start with you. That was your grandmother that was portrayed by Julie Andrews in the film. And I have to ask you, how were the characterizations? Was that really what your grandmother was like and your grandfather as well?
Yeah, that was probably what she was like on a good day. You know, it's it's always interesting when one writes one's own story. The movie The Sound of Music and the stage play were based upon my grandmother's book called The Story of the Trapp Family Singers. So, of course, it tells her version of it. And she was a very strong person. So my Aunt Maria, who was the actual real reason that my grandmother Maria came to stay with the family, my Aunt Maria had been sick and was not able to walk to and from school every day. So my grandmother Maria actually came just to be her tutor. But she said that my grandmother was extremely fun. in the beginning. And later on, she became a pretty strong matriarch who really held the family together.
I've heard that the family calls her the tyrannical saint.
Well, that was actually a joke. That actually came from Theodore Bekel, who played my grandfather on Broadway, and he came to know my grandmother a little bit. But the issue that many of my aunts have is really with the portrayal of my grandfather, that he was actually much kinder than that in real life and much more gentle father.
Well, there's a couple changes, actually, in the movie, and I want to turn to you, Daniel Truett. You played Rolf in the movie, and, of course, in the film, Rolf turns the Von Trapps into the Nazis. In the original Broadway show, Rolf doesn't do that. I'm wondering how you felt about that change.
Well, the main reason I got the role was the first thing I had to do was the last scene in the picture, because part of the problem they'd had with the sound music, including certain directors, was that they thought it was a little saccharine sweet. So they had Ernest Lehman, the Academy Award-winning screenwriter, redo this, and they went to the character of Rolf because they wanted to bring in more the reality of the tragedy of what children went through and the indoctrination that would make them do such a thing as this, because they felt the film needed more of that realistic part. So, yes, they did redo it from the original play, and that's the first scene I had to shoot in the picture, actually, was the crypt scene to make sure that it was going to work and it was believable, and because I was the actual last person cast in the film, so it was very important for me in that character. So even though I was the turncoat bad guy, that's the reason I got the role, so I really can't complain, although I would prefer that people would think more of Rolf and Liesel in the gazebo.
Well, but we shouldn't gloss over this. This was Hollywood's first touch of the Holocaust, really, 45 years ago after World War II. It was a very sensitive, difficult subject.
Well, absolutely, and you know, I think that that's what the Sound of Music was trying to portray a little bit more, to give it more of the strength and not just be so, you know, just songs, which were wonderful, but at least it did at least give the reality of the tragedy of the Holocaust and the tragedy to both Americans, people fighting, as well as the German people, how they all suffered over this horrible movement of supremacy and indoctrination, which it was. But to take a musical like Richard Rodgers and Hammerstein did is truly incredible that it was that successful, and it's like no other. It's played on television 3 times a year and has endured. I still get fan mail from all over the world, and no film has had the impact that this one has.
Well, Sam, I'm interested in wondering what kind of impact it's had on your life as the grandson of Maria von Trapp, and I'm wondering how present was this film and this story in your life as you were growing up?
You know, it's interesting. As a kid, I did watch it, and my parents tell me that I liked it very much. But then we really kept it at arm's length. And in our family, I think there was a real quest within all of my relatives to try to stay grounded and stay humble. And I think that they felt that if they were to really acknowledge and accept that this movie about our family was that popular, and if they were to actually accept that they were famous, I think they thought they might lose touch of some of those basic values. I really didn't see it again until I was 23, actually. So people would ask me questions like, did the nuns really steal the spark plugs? And I would look at them and say, what are you talking about? So I finally got it all figured out when I was 23. I was living in Mexico and studying Spanish with a family down there, and I watched it in Spanish.
Was there any one thing in the film that bothered either your grandfather or grandmother where they said, well, that was not right?
No, I think the only issue was really just, you know, there were some small changes, but the structure is there. As I said, my aunts were a little bit disappointed that my grandfather seemed so stern. But what I think is most important is that the integrity and the principles come through, and the fact that my family were able to stand up to the Nazis, and not everyone was in a position to do that.
Sam von Trapp, grandson of the real-life Maria von Trapp, standing up to the Nazis there. He runs the Von Trapp Family Lodge up in Vermont, which is about as close to Austria as you can get here in the United States.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah.
We are, of course, celebrating the 45th anniversary of the movie Sound of Music. We also spoke with Daniel Truett. He played Rolf, Liesel's boyfriend, in The Sound of Music. And lots of people, it is an enduring movie, not just the movie itself, but the music. And we continue the celebration by lots of people. We have a playlist, actually, of our favorite covers of music from The Sound of Music. Remixes, musical nods, everything from John Coltrane to Kenny G, LL Cool J, Gwen Stefani.
LL's the most rugged, God, and no man's above it. Gotta love it.
Lonely Goat Herd? No.
Don't Ray Me.
Climb Every Mountain?
Don't Ray Me. Check it out at thetakeaway.org in the blog section.
We've been talking numbers all morning. What's in a number? Tom emails us, wow, numbers are important. Stop the presses. Maybe you can do a follow-up piece on why we need letters. You better act quickly, though, before you get scooped by Sesame Street. Thanks for your support, Tom. Take this number, 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'd like to hear your voice so we can find you on the street sometime. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Well, that's fantastic.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.